It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
One, why is a college loan more valuable than a small business loan? Is it okay to be white? And how much should you be paid if you were a descendant of slaves? Two, Japan is in hospice. Japan is dying. And the United States of America is sitting in the waiting room. Three, Deion Sanders, a preacher and a controversial preacher when it comes to the University of Colorado, defensive tackles, and quarterbacks. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to the weekend. Welcome to Friday. I say that somewhat absent-mindedly each and every week with the acknowledgement that you're probably at some point hitting play as you're beginning to relax into a 2 or 3 day weekend. There seems to be some kind of growing movement afoot to move towards a 4 day work week. That's been something that people have talked about for quite some time, but some 40 odd school districts in the state of Texas have already moved to the 4 day school week. And much of Europe has begun to move in the direction, officially, not just unofficially, of working just 4 days a week. Could we move that way here in the United States? Would that be progress? Would that be refinement? I'm so captivated with several of our conversations this past week. In our conversation with Lindy Man, Paul Skellis, we talked about refinement culture, and we talked about sports, arriving at a place where he used a phrase that just captivated my mind. Maybe we've just figured these sports out. I don't know if that's true, but data analytics and monotony have sort of revealed the full optimization of baseball, basketball, soccer. Ratings are down in most definitely baseball and basketball. Everything seems to be getting just a bit more boring. I think sports is and always has been and will continue to be local moving forward. You care about your teams. And hope does spring eternal. It really feels spring right now. I mean, you've got spring ball and college football, the NFL draft combine. We're about to have conference tournaments and then March Madness in college basketball. Everything right now is full of hope. I love this sports offseason as much as I love the season. I love the NFL draft. I'm all in on the Texas Rangers right now and figuring out their rotation as every single player has the proverbial upside. And I think the Texas Longhorns basketball team still has some hope in the Big 12 tournament and in the NCAA tournament. So I'm full of hope. It's spring. But as I continue to get older, I feel like my sports watching has narrowed. Now, I don't know if that's a product of these games being refined and becoming monotonous and boring, or as you get older and you have to prioritize, you keep a passionate interest in your staked game. I have a staked interest in the Texas Rangers. I have a staked interest in the Dallas Mavericks. I have a staked interest in the Texas Longhorns and the Dallas Cowboys. But I know that my most passionate sports these days is coming down to where I have the most staked interest. Man, there's nothing I love more than going to soccer practice. There's nothing I love more than giving Coach Dad talk about you have it all in between your ears. You have all the athleticism that you need. Do you have the heart to fight and bang bodies and win every small battle? And then go to practice and see my man turn it on like 100 miles an hour, stealing balls, making runs. And I wonder, where is that in the game? But I love it all, man. I love that conversation with my sons. I love soccer practice. If I weren't in New York City hosting Fox and Friends weekend, I would love games. I watch them streaming live on Veo and VO Live and all the different apps that our wonderful team managers put games up on over the weekend. But there is nothing. There's no bigger staked interest for me than my son's soccer. This coming weekend, though, there will be a staked interest in sports for me. Okay, it's the culmination. Pete Hegseth has made fun of me at various times over the past 2 months. Oh, Will, you published 20 New Year's resolutions, and God came in at number 19. Let's see how you're doing. Let's do it on Fox and Friends. And I said, bring it. I'm not worried. Yeah, I put out 20. I'm ready for an accountability bowl. I want to know, am I living up to my goals? I know I've checked several off the list. I went duck hunting, and I'm going to work on it for next season. I've been eating right. Hey, I'm 5 pounds down. Remember my friend that said I got a fat face? I put on 5 and I've been tired. Well, I've been trying to watch my sleep. I've cut back on my alcohol. That was on the list. And I sleep better every night. And I don't have a like diet that I am following. All I'm doing is no sugar, no complex processed carbs. And I think it's working a little. One of you sent me a note. I think it was on Instagram. Said my face was not as fat. Thank you. I think I'm down 5 pounds, 190 to about 185. So I'm making progress, Hegseth. You want an accountability bowl? I'm ready. All 20 of those New Year's resolutions. But you know, at the beginning of the year, I signed up for this 9 weeks of rowing. 9 weeks on the C2 rowing machine, not on the water. And I've been doing it. It's 3 times a week, and it is tough. I mean, it's on average an hour on the rowing machine. I would say it's on average between 8 and 12,000 meters on the rowing machine. It's a weird thing. My butt goes numb. My legs at some point don't have full feeling. I don't know if that's sciatica. I don't know. Or what it is. But I do think it's good exercise. I get a blood blister. I've had a permanent blood blister on one of my palms. What do you call that area of your, at the base of your fingers, you know, where you get the calluses from pull-ups and grabbing bars. One of them's got a permanent blood blister for the past 3 months. But the moment of truth has arrived. At the end of this 9 weeks of rowing, which, as I've mentioned, includes several heavy hitters, Olympians, former Olympians in rowing, a few collegiate rowers, there is a race. A 2K. Now, you do it on your own. This whole thing is conducted on your own. There's a spreadsheet of workouts. You do your row. You take a picture of the little computer that shows how you performed in that particular workout, and we coordinate it through WhatsApp, and everybody can see your performance. So there's accountability along the way. So you understand your pace. Everyone else does. And I would say, well, I can say exactly, there's roughly 50 people in this rowing group. I know that because they've broken us into 4 teams of about a dozen. The teams are the elites. I'm not an elite. There are the crafty veterans. There are the femme fatales. And there is the rookies. I'm in the rookie group. And the way that we win is there's a projected pace that we have to keep. And if we outperform our pace, then we win as a team. Our net outperformance. So, in the pursuit of accountability, my assigned net pace for 2,000 meters rowing is 7 minutes and 24 seconds. That's roughly a 500 pace of 1 minute and 51 seconds, held up over 400 or 500 units. I think I can beat it. Now, I've learned something about myself. Maybe I already knew this. I'm an optimist. I definitely believe I'm a realist. I take my optimism and then I try to poke holes in it and I subject it to what I think is reality to see if it holds up. But I'm not a pessimist. I don't go around saying I can't, I won't, I'll fail. I don't go around saying it won't work. So the only real question is my confidence earned? Is my optimism real? I think I can do a 720. I think I can break the 1 minute 50 second barrier for a 500. I think my goal is going to be to hold up a 148, maybe a 149 over 2,000 meters. Now, it's possible, some of my competitors, it might be probable that a few of my buddies who are my competitors are listening to the Will Kane podcast. And I want you to know, I know you're faster than me. So I might even go faster than that. I will come back next week. It won't be on Monday's episode of the Will Kane podcast because I'm going to do my row on Monday. And we're all going to have a big accountability bowl on Monday night and see who won. The crafty veterans, the elites, the femme fatales, or the rookies. And whether or not I outpaced a few of my buddies. So next Wednesday, I'll be here. Did I beat 720? Story number one. Is it okay to be white? What's it worth to be the descendant of a slave? Why is a student loan more valuable to society than a small business loan? This week, the Supreme Court of the United States heard arguments over President Joe Biden's executive order to dismiss roughly $500 billion in student loan debt. The Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts grilled the Biden administration over not just the legality and the practicality, but also the morality of dismissing roughly $500 billion in debt. It would add up to roughly 40 million Americans, 40 million borrowers in student loan debt, up to $20,000 in debt. This is, of course, a major play by the Biden administration to appease the left side of his political flank. The student loan debt crisis has been a cause célèbre among young people, among celebrities, among teachers' unions for quite some time. And there is no doubt that student loan debt is out of control. And that's largely due to not a lack of involvement when it comes to the government forgiving student loan debt, but an over-involvement in the government in subsidizing student tuition to higher education. College is not unlike the hospital. Education is not unlike medicine. With a third-party payer stepping in and subsidizing the cost to the point at which the consumer has less of a concern over the cost, the provider inevitably raises costs. You know how that works in medicine. Because you and I don't pay the bill, because our health insurance pays the bill, we don't even ask how much we owe. We don't even know how much we owe. How much was that x-ray, doctor? How many times has that actually crossed your lips? Oh, you know what your copay may be. You know what your deductible may be. But you don't know what the actual service cost. And that's because there's a third party that steps in the form of an insurance company and pays the bill. The doctor in turn, the hospital in turn, raises the prices because the insurance company doesn't pay a full 100% of the claim. Knowing they're going to get a haircut on their prices, the hospitals and doctors raise their prices yet again. And then the insurance company and the doctor are in this game of, remember the game when we all sat around and put your hand on top of one another and it's a race to put your hand on top, like the Three Stooges? That's the cost dynamic in medicine. And it's the cost dynamic in education as well. A significant percentage of higher education is subsidized through federal government grants and loans. And it's no coincidence then that the price of tuition in college significantly outpaces inflation. It's insane how much college costs have inflated. I know we've talked about this. I looked it up last summer just out of curiosity. And at that time, and look, that was almost, what, 7-8 months ago. I don't know what the increase is for yet another year of tuition. But at that time, a private school tuition like, say, Baylor or TCU is, you're going to have to put the over-under at roughly $80,000 a year, including room and board. A public school tuition, you think in your mind, at least I do, public school in-state tuition, we're looking at something like $10,000 a year, maybe $15,000 a year. No, it's up to $25,000, $30,000 a year for in-state tuition to your Texas Techs, your Florida States. It's just out of control. But the answer to that cannot be more federal government subsidization through the forgiveness of loan. Now, how does the Biden administration, how does the executive branch even have the power to just poof, say goodbye to $500 trillion in debt? Well, the argument made by the Biden administration is that because we were in a pandemic, because it was an emergency, they could invoke something called the HEROES Act, which was passed in 2003, and gives the Secretary of Education the ability to adjust the way they pay back loans and therefore manipulate tuitions in the face of an emergency. The Supreme Court justices thought, well, okay, that was kind of, though, about tweaking things along the way, not just mafia-style disappearing IOUs to not just the colleges, but ultimately, of course, to the federal government, and then ultimately, of course, to the taxpayer. Nothing just disappears. There is no magic. If these students, former students, do not pay back their loans, the money doesn't just grow on trees or get thrown into the East River, to build upon the analogy of the mafia. No, it goes to your and my taxes. Better yet, it goes to the taxes of the landscaper. Here's what I mean by that. There is, of course, the legal question. There's also the economic question. This is going to be yet another injection of essentially cash into the system, a system that is rife with inflation. In fact, our system is so rife with inflation that this week, famed investor, you know, probably the guy I listen to the most when it comes to our economy, Warren Buffett, in his annual letter to Berkshire Hathaway shareholders, said that we are on the verge of something catastrophic. I want to get Buffett's exact words correct. But Buffett said, in essence, that we were looking at massive worldwide recessions, and in the short term, catastrophe in the economic markets. This, of course, Buffett says he believes in the American economy over the long term, but this, of course, is a product of the federal government and worldwide economies attempting to tame inflation. In order to do so, they're going to have to raise interest rates, which is going to raise the cost of borrowing to feed this student loan crisis full circle. Well, this is such a concern that Congress, in a bipartisan manner, this week passed something called the Rein In Act. The Rein In Act said that any executive orders coming out of the Biden administration would need to be subjected to a deep dive analysis of its effects upon inflation. Now, this is so serious that something like 53, 59 Democratic members of Congress voted along with over 200 Republican members of Congress to pass the Rein In Act. It has to pass through the Senate. And will it ever have any real effect on executive spending is almost beside the point. It's rather a recognition that we are in this moment that is recognized by the likes of Warren Buffett and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, although she was not one of the 50 to worry about inflation. It's real. And doing away with student loan is yet another inflationary log thrown on this recessionary fire. But beyond the economics and the legality of the question before the Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Roberts asked a very important moral question to the Biden administration. Why is it that you should forgive the debt and student loans of a college graduate, but you would not for a small business owner who's taken out a loan to start up his landscaping business? Why is it that that student is more valuable to America and more forgivable in his inability to repay debt than the landscaper? Let me transition here as we begin to answer that question into yet another governmental action from this past week. The city of San Francisco has, in the past month or two, voted to provide for reparations for Black Americans in San Francisco. Slavery and civil rights reparations for San Franciscans who are black. That has all kinds of accompanying questions. Let's start with how. How do you decide who gets what? San Francisco says $5 million is the what. That's right. The city of San Francisco says that those eligible for reparations can receive $5 million. Who qualifies for this $5 million payout in reparations? Black residents of San Francisco. But that, of course, isn't quite workable. That's not quite a definition. So the city of San Francisco said the following. Anyone over 18 years old who is black and who has been black, who identifies as black for 10 years, and then satisfies two of eight criteria which include been in San Francisco between the years 1940 and 1996, born in San Francisco, rather, between the years 1940 and 1996. These are and/ors. Two of eight that include that, a residency in San Francisco for 13 years, and/or personally or direct descendant of someone incarcerated for the war on drugs. That seems maybe different than what you had imagined. You would think reparations would be reserved for those who are at the very least descendants of slavery. But of course, in the modern day social justice world of the United States of America, the war on drugs is a vestige, an emanation of slavery, meaning that if you are personally, in other words, if you were a drug dealer who went to jail, or you're a descendant of a drug dealer, someone who was incarcerated for the war on drugs, you have satisfied one of the requirements for $5 million in reparations from the city of San Francisco. When asked how they arrived at this qualification, members of the San Francisco City Council said the following. It was more of a journey than a math formula. Oh, interesting. Not a math formula, a journey. Sort of like Rachel Dolezal's claim to being black. Not exactly genetic, more of a journey. Of course, this is all bullshit. San Francisco doesn't have the money to pay $5 million to people who satisfy these qualifications. And they know that. There was some nonsense about medical marijuana taxes going to it. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket. And they literally, like a minute fraction of the amount of money that would be required to generate $5 million for every qualifying black resident of San Francisco. And they know it. They know they don't have the money. It is, like so many racial justice initiatives, hollow, nothingness, shallow virtue, not for the one who would receive the $5 million in reparations, but the one who is so benighted to grant the non-existent magic make-believe fairy dust $5 million in reparations. It's for them and what they see in the mirror. It's not for you and your electric bill. That's the case of so many DEI initiatives. I found this week. This is absolutely fascinating. So this came from several sources this week. There's been some studies on DEI initiatives as we begin to enter this recession, as is predicted to get worse by the likes of Warren Buffett. Layoffs have started to come in, right? And what they found is that DEI jobs, diversity, equity, and inclusion jobs, like chief diversity officer jobs, went up within corporate America in the wake of the death of George Floyd by 55%. But now that recessionary pressures have stepped in and started to cause layoffs, DEI jobs have experienced layoffs by 33%. This is as compared to 21% for non-DEI jobs. Okay, but that's not the most fascinating thing we found out here. Listen to this. Of the DEI jobs, chief diversity officer, HR, whatever it may be, only 3.8% of those jobs have gone to someone who is black. This is going to come as no surprise. Right now, you're probably adding it up as you're listening. 76% of DEI jobs went to people who were white. Now, all of these people who are experiencing these layoffs are going, yeah, well, we didn't quite get it the right way done. The real trick now is to move into ESG, environmental, social, and governance initiatives. We've talked about that here on the Will Caim podcast. 3.8% of DEI jobs to people who are black, 76% to people who are white. And look, hey man, that's not that easy to figure out. We just talked about the city of San Francisco has to figure out who qualifies as black to get their make-believe $5 million in reparations. And in the world of Rachel Dolezal, that's getting increasingly difficult. You know, a world that says victimization is currency, that incentivizes minority status, and oh, it does, will be a world that looks like Rachel Dolezal, people pretending to be minority to follow that incentive. Oh, come on, Will. Rachel Dolezal, that's one example. Let me introduce you to Raquel Avida Saraswati. Raquel Saraswati was written up this week in The Intercept. Raquel is a Muslim activist. She identifies as a person of color. She has at times throughout her career identified as a Latina, a South Asian, an Arab, oh, and by the way, queer. She has been the chief DEI officer for the American Friends Service Committee. It's unfortunate that Raquel Avida Saraswati, though, would not help those DEI numbers that reveal that 76% of DEI jobs go to people who are white. Because Raquel Avida Saraswati's real name is Rachel Elizabeth Seidel. And old Rach, well, they found her mom at The Intercept. And her mom said, "I'm as white as the driven snow. And so is she." Her mom went on to give a direct quote. "I don't know why she's doing what she's doing. She's living a lie." Oh, Ma, I know why she's doing what she's doing. Because she's following the incentive of victimization and employment. She's one of the 76% of white people who got a job in DEI. Now, of course, there are many saying, if you look back into Rachel's past, she was actually someone who's identifying as Arab, but a moderate Arab in the wake of 9/11. And then she was advocating for conservative causes. And they say right wing. Who knows what right wing is? And there's a suggestion she might be a plant, maybe even by the FBI. I don't know. It gets really complicated really fast. We're deep into not just transgender, but transracialism. Hey, and by the way, why not? Right? We're headed. Look, if you can be transgender, why can't you be transracial? They both defy genetics. Help me out. If gender is divorced from sex, and sex is your genetic assignment at birth, male or female, but gender is your internal identity, why can you not have certain genetic requirements for the way you were born with race, but internally identify as another race? I don't get why Rachel can't be Raquel. I don't get why Rachel Dolezal can't be black at the NAACP. I don't get it. If you can be transgender, why can't you be trans race? And by the way, at the end of trans race, then we move on to trans age. And it's coming. You know it's coming. And wait for the first inventive 16-year-old who goes, MIP, I'm 22. Minor in possession? No, thank you, Judge. I identify as 23. And that's happening. And why can't I, at the age of 47, identify as 65 and start getting my Medicare benefits? Why can't I? It's all internal. It's how I identify. I don't get it. Explain. Can we get a scientist in here? Can we explain the logical distinction between transgender and transracial? Yeah, Ma, I get why Rachel wanted to identify as a Muslim DEI activist. She's following the incentive. As so many things, these DEI scams have been a payoff for who? White women. White women, the biggest beneficiaries of DEI, in the past half decade, further illustrating just how hollow and empty so much of what has happened in our racial reckoning has been in the United States of America. We give hollow jobs that we fire at the first sign of a recession. We give those jobs to white women to enforce DEI initiatives. And then we pass in San Francisco fake reparations to give to people we cannot define as descendants of slavery or deserving of reparations. All of it designed to give a pat on the back to the person giving out this as the benefactor of societal virtue. By the way, while we're on this note, you know, it was this week that, what's his name? Scott Adams, the creator of Dilbert, the cartoon in the newspapers, went online and he gave a screed, a racist screed. I think, and I would love to talk to Scott, I do think it was legitimately racist, where he said that white people should move away from black people. And in that poll, and the reason that Scott brings this up and the reason he started talking about it is that he cited a poll for Rasmussen where 53%, this is the poll from Rasmussen, 53% of black Americans said it's okay to be white. 53% of black Americans said it's okay to be white. Well, I mean, I think that's kind of bearing the headline, right? So 47% say it's not okay to be white. That's sort of a big deal. And of course, like, what's going into that? You know, I don't think it's just black Americans that would answer this way. There's some viral videos going out about, it shows people, not just in America, black people, but people in, there was one, people in UK asking them, what would they say? What's good about white straight men? And then people won't answer. Nothing. I mean, that's the politically correct group since its answer to give. Nothing good. Hey, by the way, we're not talking about supremacy here. We're not talking about pro. We're not talking about championing. We're asking, is it okay? Is it okay? Like, it's not okay to be you and your birth, assigned birth characteristics. I thought that was racist. But it's okay to be white is a proposition that people, I think black or white, have trouble going, yeah, of course it's okay to be white. And of course it is. It's okay to be black. It's okay to be Asian. It's okay to be Indian. It's okay to be Mexican. It's okay to be white. It's okay. Of course it's okay. To be male, to be female, it's okay. Why is that so hard to say? Why is that so hard to realize? And because we have a society that can't answer the rhetorical question that I just asked, what we have is white people who pretend to be Arab, South Asian, Latino, that was all of Raquel's choices, or black in the case of Rachel Dolezal. The entire societal incentive structure is set up in a new neo-racist prism. We're far, far removed from what was it, maybe the 1990s, the early 2000s, the mid-2000s, of striving to arrive, not pretending like ostriches with our head in the sand that we can ignore race, but striving to arrive at a place of colorblindness, of truly seeing each other according to our character, our actions, and judgment upon our merits. We are neo-racists in order to pat ourselves on the back for our hollow virtue. We're buying. We're purchasing. We're paying penance. People are paying penance for being white. It's not okay to be white. Pay your penance. How do I pay my penance? I give my fake reparations. I find racists on Twitter. I project my own shallow virtue. We're buying our virtue. In the same way, to bring this back full circle, that we're buying support in politics by giving away free things on the backs of poor people. So, the moral question that Chief Justice John Roberts asks of the Biden administration. Why is a college loan more valuable to society than a small business loan? Why should a tech employee at Google with $120,000 in debt have that forgiven based upon the tax-paying dollars of the guy who still owes his bank a loan for starting his landscaping business? Why? And the answer to that is they are buying support. It's not about the college graduate, by the way. Just like the cheap virtue in the mirror, it's about the benefactor. The cheap virtue signaler wants to look in the mirror and feel momentarily better. The Biden administration wants to look at the voting box and see more support from rich upper middle class kids. And this is the ugliest part of it. If you want to tell me what college degrees are more valuable than small business loans, bull. But okay, you've made the argument. But you need to build upon that. And you need to fully lay out why. Why should rich people be supported off the scarce dollars of poor people? It will be that landscaper, that blue collar worker who pays for the debt forgiveness of that Google tech employee. That's not only cheap virtue, that's not only cheap votes. That's cheap morality, an upside-down, neo-racist, elitist, self-centered, selfish society. That's more important than the economic and legal question. That's to the moral fiber of the country.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on FoxNewsPodcast.com.
Story number two. Concerning stats out of Japan that might just be the canary in the coal mine for the United States of America. Japan is in hospice. Japan is dying. And the U.S. happens to be in the waiting room. Here are the stats out of Japan. Last year, Japan had 799,000 births. That is a number that has been cut in half over the last 40 years. It is a fertility rate in Japan of 1.3. You know the replacement rate is 2.1 to replace your population. Deaths, by the way, in Japan, far outpace births in that country. And this comes at a time when Japan's real income, adjusted for inflation, how much you actually have and what you have to spend and the corresponding effect on your quality of life, has fallen from $50,000 on average for Japanese citizens in 1995 to $43,000 on average for citizens in 2022. This is what a society looks like who is dying. And by the way, Japan's not the worst in the world. South Korea has even a worse fertility rate than Japan. You know, it's interesting. You can read some deep dives on Japan and what's happened to them since the 1990s. Started with really honestly an economic stagflation, where Japan just couldn't get out of the rut that they dove into in the 1990s. And as a result, what you have is not just an economic stagnation over time, but what it turned into is a cultural stagnation as well, where in Japan, you had increasing likelihood of single life, people, young men, going later and later into life without marrying, without having children, without moving out of their parents' home, who play video games. This is all starting to sound familiar. Back then, played video games at these arcades plugged in. Remember the stories? You'd hear them out of Japan and Korea, these stories where people would die playing video games for like 15 hours on end. Now you can do that at home. You don't have to go to these massive arcades. And then the weirdest part of the Japanese cultural evolution was that people began to hang on to literally infantile style and behavior. Now you can picture this, right? Kind of like Hello Kitty stuff. You know, you picture Japanese pop culture. And everybody sort of dresses like they're nine, you know, makeup like they're nine or they're a doll, stuffed animals. It's a total cultural reversion of hanging on to adolescence and even infantile behavior late into life where you never grow up, you never become adult, you never, and of course, this isn't the entirety of Japanese society, but it's enough to be here. If you don't pay attention, what you're looking at is a society in hospice, dying. People are energy. People are ideas. People are innovation. You need new people. All these overpopulation doomsdayer, Malthusian doomsdayers, they want a world in regression. New people, new ideas. New people, new needs. New needs, new products. And life isn't all about consumerism. But do you go through the world malevolent or loving people? Do you hate people or do you love people? People are important. People are good. This is a problem in Europe as well. Declining birth rates, stagnation in ideas. Who put a man on the moon? Italy or the United States? Which one had a higher birth rate? I know. Correlation. Not causation, but strong correlation. Booming country, booming birth rates. Want to know an optimistic message? Be like my co-host on Fox and Friends Weekend. Have seven or nine kids. Pretty good indication you believe in tomorrow. This is concerning because all the same things we're seeing in Japan, we're beginning to see in the United States of America. What's our economic future? Maybe it isn't boom, bust, depression. Maybe it isn't runaway inflation like South America. Maybe it's more like Japan. Constant, cyclical, erratic stagflation. What's our culture look like? Well, we know it. Birth rates are declining in the United States of America. People staying single later in the world. People playing video games all day long. Young men having lost purpose. Suicide rates in both those cultures going up. Japan's the canary in the coal mine. The story isn't just about Japan. Because if they're in hospice, we're in the waiting room. We need to wake up and learn from the dead canary sitting in the cage.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
Story number three. University of Colorado Buffalo's head football coach, Deion Sanders. Wow, he's just full of scandal already. Deion Sanders got a letter this week from the Freedom from Religion Foundation. They sent a letter to the University of Colorado after reports were that Deion had been openly sharing his religious beliefs in an official state capacity, head football coach, employee of the state of Colorado. The letter pointed to one prayer in question that Deion has been giving in the locker room and during team meetings. It reads, "Lord, we thank you for this day, Father, for this opportunity as a group. Father, we thank you for the movement that God has put us in place to be in charge of, and we thank you for each player here, each coach, each family. In Jesus' name we pray, amen." The Freedom from Religion Foundation said that Sanders needs to have a workshop to be taught his constitutional duties under the Establishment Clause and to ensure that Sanders understands he has been hired as a football coach and not a pastor. The letter urged the school to provide the group that the coach will not continue to proselytize to his players or subject them to coercive team prayers. You know, I've always wondered this. When did the freedom of religion in the United States become the freedom from religion? That wherever you go, you can be insulated from ever hearing a religious message, even if it's someone who happens to hold a public job. I don't think freedom of religion should mean freedom from religion. I doubt any player in there was like, "Oh man, here we go. I can't. I got to go. I'm completely out of place here. This makes me so uncomfortable." You ever been around anybody who have another religion? You ever listen to them pray? Is it really something that not makes you need to run, but makes you need to end that prayer? Deion got in a lot of hot water this week, by the way. Deion also, he gave an interview, I think it was on the Rich Eisen radio show, where he said, quarterbacks. I want quarterbacks. I'm butchering this. I'm paraphrasing. I don't have it in front of me. Quarterbacks. I want two-parent family. I want I don't know if he said well off. Basically, I want my quarterback, in order for him to have the leadership traits that are necessary to come from a home where he had a good, stable upbringing, two parents, that's the generic prototype. He said, now defensive tackles can come from a single mama. I want them fighting like dogs, angry, trying to provide for mama, free and reduced lunch. He said something like that. And, you know, this made everybody upset. And why did it make everybody upset? That's a good question. Is it race? You have to draw connections, which are sloppy, right? Are there not poor, white, single-parent defensive tackles? Yes, there are. Are there black, two-parent family households? Yes, absolutely, there are. So I don't know, is it race? Is it socioeconomic that's the problem here? You know what he said? It's certainly a stereotype. But look, man, and I heard, is it Corey Simon played for Florida State on with Dan Dockich? I've seen others. Of course there are exceptions to the rules. Of course, nothing is 100% proposition. And of course, you're going to find great leaders who come from single-family homes, and you're going to find dogs that come from upper-middle-class, soft upbringings. Of course you are. But because we can identify exceptions does not negate the existence of the generalization. And that's the thing. The simple response should be, is he wrong? Like, in general, is he wrong? Because if he's not wrong, why are you mad? Like, and if he is wrong, I think it's burdens on you to show me exactly how he is wrong. And you can't point to exceptions. Exceptions are great. We're not talking about 100% principle or proposition or rule of law. We're talking about Deion, recruiting, shooting from the hip here. And I think it is probably a generalized odds-making proposition. Hungry people want to eat. Rough circumstances, tough product. Models for leadership, models for stability, education and leadership and stability. Not universal. Bunch of dirtbags that come from two parent families. And a bunch of softies who come from poor, meager environments. But is he wrong in what he said? And the other problem with this is if you say that, it's as though you endorse that reality. I don't think Deion or anybody else is passing a moral judgment. This is the way it should be, and this is a just world. No, it just is an is world. It should versus is, right? Just because it is doesn't mean it should be that way. But because it should be a different way doesn't mean we get to change the way that it is. That's the modern day progressive movement. It shouldn't be this way, therefore deny reality. I don't feel good, therefore deny my genetic reality. You overcome reality through work and effort and product, not by rejecting reality. We can identify what is and work to make what should be. I don't know what Deion said that is worthy of so much condemnation. And neither did anybody else sitting there listening that day. And I promise you, many of those people, they're ready to take up the flag of oppressor and oppressed. They're ready in that particular interview to scream political correctness. Back to Deion and praying on campus. The First Liberty Institute came to Deion Sanders' defense, and they wrote, "We write to correct the Freedom from Religion Foundation's misstatements regarding the requirements imposed by the First Amendment on public school employees' religious expression. The Supreme Court has repeatedly held that public school employees may engage in religious expression and exercise. Therefore, public universities like CU may not target Coach Sanders for exercising constitutional rights on campus." Sanders has been very open about his faith. Follow him on Instagram. You can hear him talk about it. "I can't walk on my own, and people have to help me get in and out of everything. And I say, Lord, I thank you. You say, Prime, how can you say, Lord, I thank you when it's hard for you to help yourself?" He says, "Because I'm alive." Deion ain't perfect. Deion isn't always right. Deion's generalizations aren't foolproof. Deion doesn't have to be your hero, but maybe we need more people who are willing to say what is, whether to hold their convictions straight, to be leaders of men, to give people opportunities, to be unique in a world of monotonous group consensus. Maybe we need more Deions. That's going to do it for today here on the Will Cain Podcast. I will see you again on Monday when I row 720. See you next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcast and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.